Can we have a bit of quiet from up at the back of the room, please? Because I hear you being a bit naughty up there.
Oh, us?
Yeah, you lot.
Oh, we're just quiet enough.
You'll do.
God bless you. We'll make you laugh, that. Oh, no, right. Sorry. He's all quiet, I'm all quiet.
Is anyone going to read the 12 traditions?
Both sides.
Yeah, both sides, please. Do you want to do it up here on the mic?
I can do it.
Okay.
My name's Michael Milani. We keep what we have only with vigilance, and just as freedom from the individual comes from the 12 steps, so freedom for the group springs from our traditions. As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than those that would tear us apart, all will be well. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting the group, other groups, or NA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry a message to the addict who still suffers. Six, an NA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to any related facility or outside enterprise unless problems with money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every NA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Narcotics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, NA as such will never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Narcotics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the NA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Understanding these traditions comes slowly over a period of time. We pick up information as we talk to members and visit various groups. It usually isn't until we get involved with service that someone points out that personal recovery depends on NA unity, and that unity depends on how we follow our traditions. The 12 traditions of NA are not negotiable. They are the guidelines that keep our fellowship alive and free. By following these guidelines in our dealings with others and society at large, we avoid many problems. That is not to say that our traditions eliminate all problems. We still have to face difficulties as they arise. Communication problems, differences of opinion, internal controversies, and troubles with individuals and groups outside the fellowship. However, when we apply these principles, we avoid some of the pitfalls. Many of our problems are like those that our predecessors had to face. Their hard-won experience gave birth to the traditions, and our own experience has shown that these principles are just as valid today as they were when these traditions were formulated. Our traditions protect us from internal and external forces that could destroy us. They are truly the ties that bind us together. It is only through understanding and application that they work.
Thank you, Mike.
Cheers, Mike. I'm off now, mate.
Bye,
God bless you. I don't feel quite ready yet.
Try my best then, mate. Come on, it's not happening.
One day it'll happen. Like you lot. Because you lot are our uppers. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're proof that it can be done. So we're just going to keep looking at you lot, and then probably one day we come back and we'll be saying, well, could be someone out in
front. You come back.
Yeah.
This young
lady
was in trouble. Sayonara. God bless you.
Bye.
Has our GSR any announcements to make?
Yes, well, I just hope that we've planted a few seeds for them and that they will come back before they die. I've got a couple of announcements. Legbury Road is closed tomorrow, Saturday, the 12:30 lunchtime meeting, because there's a wedding, apparently. So that's West London. 11 a.m. meeting in Kilburn needs a GSR. it's 1 year clean time. The den on Friday in Ladbroke Grove needs the GSR urgently. That's 1 year clean time. Just turn up at these meetings. The UK convention's on in the beginning of July. H and I have got vacancies for on the committee vice chair, which is quite urgent, and it's 2 years clean time, and they meet at the second Wednesday in Victoria of the second Wednesday of the month. Downview and Belmarsh urgently need secretaries. There's a phone box campaign, and they'd like suggestions for where, which phone boxes to put NA information in. If you've got any, come see me and I'll give you the right numbers to phone. North West London need a parent rep, and the helpline website needs committee needs a vice treasurer and coordinators with clean time for the forum and chat room. So there's a new new helpline website that's going to go live at the convention. So that's got a 12-step list which you can log on to, and it's all been computerised. Living Clean have got a forum on www.na.org. And you can work with what it's like to live clean. Okay, thanks.
Can we please check that our mobiles are switched off and that disruption is kept to a minimum? Thank you. Now I'm going to hand the meeting over to Mia, who's going to share with us for about up to 40 minutes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hi, my name's Mia and I'm an addict. Terrifying, my God. Matty said that he was grateful when he got off, asked to do this show. It wasn't like that for me at all. But 2 weeks ago, I was like, oh, fuck. And so yeah, she phoned me and I didn't know, I don't know her. And so I got this random number and I went, hi. And then she said she wasn't, like, oh no. And I said, and everything in my being was going, no, I don't want to, no. And my sponsor said to me when I first came in, if you're asked to do a share, you're meant to do it, and you just say yes. And so literally everything in my being, no, and then what actually came out was yes. And here I am 2 weeks later, having obsessed about it for approximately 2 weeks. It's quite right. Annie said that this is just another meeting. It doesn't, the fact that there's a microphone, the fact that there's maybe a few more people than normal, it can be as big a deal as I want to make it, really. Right, that's quite a big deal. And my fear, I'm going to talk about the fear a little bit to begin with, mainly because the level of fear that I feel right now is completely irrational and self-centred. It's not based in reality at all. I've thought about the worst outcomes of me doing this share quite a lot. And for me, the two worst ones would be that I would dry up and not have anything to say, or I would feel that I've embarrassed myself. Though for me, those would be the two most shaming things. I've done a share before and dried up and not word to say, and it was fairly embarrassing, but no one used on it. It wasn't the worst thing in the world. I just kind of went, well, that was uncomfortable, wasn't it? And what my mistake was that I started talking about relationships and my ex-boyfriend was directly in front of me, and so I kind of, so I started talking, and then I went, oh, crap, and I didn't know where to go, and then it was curtains. He's not here tonight. So that's my fear. And it'll be all right. 40 minutes feels like a ludicrous amount of time, but I'll share for as long as I can. And sharing, actually, with sharing, I moved to London about 2 years ago, and I wouldn't say that I've tried my hardest to get into the fellowship that is on offer in this city. I go to meetings, certainly. I've made friends. Not as many as I did in the town that I got clean in, but and through my kind of not really getting into the fellowships that are on offer, is the only person that's missing out is me, because it's like going to the coffees and all of that stuff and really kind of getting to know each other on that kind of personal level, as opposed to the kind of just hardcore meeting level, is kind of paramount to what we do here. It's all about making new friendships and building them, and I find it really difficult to share in meetings. It scares the shit out of me for the reasons that I've said. And what happens for me is the longer that I leave it in between sharing, I don't mean doing like a chair, I mean just like putting your hand up or whatever and sharing in a meeting. The longer I leave it, the harder it is. And then when I do finally have something going on and I process it with my sponsor or someone who's in my kind of my help group or whatever, they say share it in a meeting, and then it's doubly hard because it's been so long. So sharing is so important, and it's a shame when me or anyone else would allow a little thing like fear to get in the way. Although it feels so massive, the fear, it is in reality just a feeling that will pass within 10 minutes. Today I had a phone call. Hang on. Today I had a phone call from a guy who I used with a lot. Messy Matt, his name is. I was Messy Mia. I'm from Weymouth in Dorset. It's a little seaside town. And I moved away. I did a lot of using it and drinking in Weymouth, and then went to rehab, moved away, and kind of relocated. Blah blah. And I didn't see any of my friends or anything for about a year. But when I did go back, I never really, if anyone asked me about going to rehab or going to meetings and stuff, I'd tell them about it, but I didn't really throw it at them, mainly because I didn't think that they would get it. And also, I didn't want to be that one. They're all still drinking and using. I didn't want to be that one who goes, like, just kind of trying to push recovery on people. It's not really my style. But the beauty of it is that people still notice, and people still kind of see that I can go to a pub and kind of just have a Diet Coke or whatever. By 10, I'm bored shitless, but I can still do that. And they sense that. And my friend phoned me today and said that that he's in trouble and that he wants some help and he wants to get clean and he wants to do all of this stuff. So today I've kind of been making phone calls to the treatment centre that I went to, putting that in place for him, but still giving him the responsibility to do it. And for me, what is important now, he's got an assessment, all of that's happening, but what for me, it's important for me to let that go now, not try to control the man's whole recovery, or like pick him up and take him to the assessment, which is what my kind of people-pleasing things wants to do. I carry a message, I don't kind of throw it at people or carry them to the message. So I feel quite good about that, and in it, maybe he won't go to treatment, maybe he won't get clean, but the seed has been planted in him now, which is kind of beautiful. Am I done yet? No. I said, you don't think I'm going to puke now, which is nice. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my using and kind of childhood and stuff, and I never do that in shares because normally it's 15 minutes and there's no time. Now I have time, I have nothing but time. Yeah, so when I was a kid, my mum, not going to like, born in 81, not going to do all that, I'll do it quite briefly. My mum left my dad because he drank, whether he's an alcoholic or not, I flit in and out of that. What I do know is that for me, I don't like to call people addicts or alcoholics. If they want to call themselves that, then that's fair enough. People drink seemingly successfully. To the extent that I drank and used, but they don't seem to feel the guilt and shame that I felt the next day. So therefore, does that make them an addict? I don't know. But my mum certainly wasn't a fan of my dad's drinking, and they split up. And what that kind of left me with was one part of my mum's side of the family, like these kind of middle-class media types, and then my dad's side of the family were all kind of like working class in construction, went to the pub, that's their life. And so I was kind of... I didn't feel comfortable in either of those places. I didn't feel comfortable with anything. The easiest way for me to sum up how I felt as a child was that I didn't feel enough. I didn't feel pretty enough, articulate enough, interesting enough, funny enough, anything that I thought... In fact, you know what, all of those qualities that I just explained, then I actually have all of those things. Maybe not to the standard, now I know that, maybe not to the standard that I would like to attain in a perfect world, but that was my truth back then. And I remember like kind of going, when I was to stay with my dad at weekends, we'd always go to the pub, and like dad would be in the bar with the blokes drinking beer. I would be in the on the climbing frame or outside with a packet of crisps and a pound of pop. That's how it went. And with all the other kids, all the parents were pissed, which was fine. Well, in hindsight, not so fine, but at the time it just was. And I remember kind of going into the bar with my dad, and that was like the highlight of those kind of those things, of going into the bar and watching all the men, and they all laughing and with the beer, and it all looked fantastic. And I really kind of wanted, I'm talking, I'm 5 or 6, and I really, that was where I thought I was going to come into my own, really. That's where I thought I would feel comfortable. And I kind of did for quite a while. And then, and then my childhood, in fact, my using is so boring in textbook. I always thought it was really interesting and kind of unique. And it's dull as dishwater. I started drinking and using really young, probably about, the first time I remember really being kind of abusing alcohol was when I was about 11. And my mum went off to work and I nicked a bottle of wine. I don't know if anyone remembers this film called Muriel's Wedding. Okay, so I'm like 11, 12, something like that, and I nicked this bottle of wine, drank on my own, drank it, watched the film, and then sobbed to myself thinking that I was Muriel and that I'm never going to get married, no one's ever going to love me, all of this kind of self-pity with a bottle of vino in my hand. And I don't think I ever got caught for that, but that was like my kind of first memory of looking back, which was a little bit fucked up, really. And then my... As I said, my using was kind of pretty boring. By the time I was about 16, I was pretty messy. And my mum, with the middle-class media type thing, little therapy and all of that stuff was bandied around. And for years, my mum said, I think you need to go and see a counsellor, you need to go and see a therapist because of your anger. I didn't even really think I was that angry, but she remembers it differently. That's something that's beautiful that I've realised in recovery as well. It's like kind of events and situations in my childhood that to me, I see as this thing where I was the victim or something terrible happened to me. Other people who were involved in that situation remember it completely differently. And it's no necessarily, none of us are right or wrong. It's just people's perceptions and how things affect me as a kind of a very sensitive person. I allowed things to affect me, probably more so than I really had the right to. The nerves are back. Mm-hmm. Hang on. It's pathetic. So by 16, there was one heinous night, we've all had many, and drank a bottle of Jack Daniels and no taxis would take. It was a New Year's Eve, my mum was having a party at the house, no taxis would take me, my friend phoned my mum, said you've got to come and get her, big drama. So then, I don't remember any of this. And then so the next morning, woke up with the dread really, that horrible guilt and shame that I haven't experienced since I got clean, thank God. And my mum said, for the 15th time, said I think you need to see a counsellor, and she kind of caught me on the right day and I went away then. Mainly because I wanted her to like me again, because she was really angry. So then I started to go and see this counsellor, and I lived in London at this time, and he said to me, I was 16, he said, you're an addict, I might have been 15 or whatever, you're an addict, you're an alcoholic, you need to go to meetings, you need to go to rehab, that's what you need to do. And I kind of thought, oh, really? Again, I kind of wanted him to like me too, and I really didn't like myself, and I thought maybe there is some truth in it, I don't know. So I did go to a meeting, and I went and looked around a rehab centre in Weston-super-Mare, and I got accepted to that treatment centre. Then we had to get funding, and the guy who assessed me for the funding, and he said, no, you're not an addict, you're not an alcoholic, you're a 16-year-old doing what every other 16-year-old does. And I went, oh, right. So this guy who had like met me for 15 minutes kind of contradicted everything that had been said. And so that kind of, the rehab thing went out the water, but then the NA thing was still being drummed into me. I went, all right, I'll go to a meeting. So I went to this meeting at 16, stoned, and when they said at the beginning, if you've got any drugs or paraphernalia on you, please take my stuff, I thought, well, I have. It was like, I had like a tenth of weed. And I thought, they're going to know. I thought, I can't get up and go and stash it and then come back in, because then they'll definitely know. And then I thought, can they smell it? And then I thought, it's a tenth, they can't smell it. And so I just sat there and I was listening to people, and you could smoke in meetings then as well. So it was real thick fog of smoke. And I was there with my Lamberts. Crying so much. And then this woman came over and like bought this grotty toilet roll and just plonked it next to me and then went and sat back down. And I went, thank you. And so I sat there sobbing with this crusty toilet roll next to me. And then smoke everywhere and they sort of like proper, and like the way that I deemed it, proper addicts, as opposed to my little pathetic sniffing coke and taking pills. And And I went back a few times, and I'm not resentful over this, but my truth is that no one came up to me and kind of, at the end of the meeting and said, are you all right? Is everything, but no one kind of offered me any help. But that's all right, because I'm glad I didn't get clean then anyway. I had some fun in between those years. But the thing is, with the meetings then, and I'd read a load of the literature with that thing of me not feeling articulate or interesting enough, I used to read a lot to think that that'll do it, but then couldn't retain any of the information because I was stoned. And so I read a lot of literature about recovery, and so I kind of planted a seed, and I knew that in order for me, on a kind of like a core level, I knew that in order for me to attain any kind of happiness or contentment in my life, I needed to be clean, really. I kind of knew that. But I wasn't ready. So I went about my business. But what I did do at that time is I thought, what I'll do is I'll stop taking chemicals and I'll just drink. That's the answer. And then I'll move. I slept with my best friend's boyfriend, so I had to move anyway. But that was really uncomfortable. So instead of, that's classic addict, instead of dealing with that situation where I'd done this horrendous thing, I just moved. And so I went there and gave up chemicals. But then this is where my addicts can really get me, and why I need to be totally abstinent from all mood-altering substances, is because that alcohol wasn't enough. It kind of just opened the doors. And although I didn't do chemicals for a few years, I started overeating and I started kind of having one-night stands and stuff like that. And that was actually the most kind of soul-destroying part of my using, was when I was kind of, well, a slag, basically. And like, if men ever wanted to see me after that first night, I would always be kind of like, really? And it would, and I never kind of got into any relationship, even more than like two dates relationships, because I couldn't, if anyone wanted to, I thought they would be clearly insane to want to spend any more time with me. So why would I want to be with you anyway? Oh, Christ. And yeah, seriously though, for that kind of, I mean, sex addiction's a bit over, for me, is a bit over the top. It wasn't that, it was just kind of just wanting to feel a connection with someone in any way that I could, and that was the only way that I could really see. I don't do that anymore, just let's make that clear. I really don't, I'm not just saying. So after a few years, like, the chemicals came back in, of course they did, blah. And then when I went back again to the rooms when I was 18, and this isn't quite as humorous, but I got 13, so I was 18, so it wasn't quite as weird for men to come up and try and chat me up as when I was 16. So I got 13th step by this guy at 18. I was only in for about two, I was in recovery, well, I wasn't even recovery, I was sober for about 2 weeks maybe. And this guy kind of, there was all this, and this is NA as well, I never really went to it, I don't know, I keep saying sober, it's clean. And so all this hugs, not drugs business, and so there was all these, like, quite attractive men there, and then they were all hugging, and I went, all right. And so I kind of, then this guy came up to me, and he was quite hot, and he said, what we do is we swap numbers here, and then if you ever want to talk about anything, then you can give me a call. And I went, oh, all right, then, fair enough. And so I swapped numbers with him, and he started texting me, hugs, not drugs, and I went, all right. And then we kind of, I used to go round to his house, and I'd, like, for the first time, I really kind of got, well, as close to vulnerable as I'd ever got. I really kind of talked to him about my insecurities about weight and all of that girly shit. And, sorry, it's not just girly shit, it's actually not funny. But, and so I really kind of opened up to him, and he basically, when I wouldn't sleep with him, he got all medieval and started all of my insecurities and that, he just threw them back at me and went, no one's ever going to want to go out of you, go and use, no one gives a shit. And so that, it was funny at the time too. It really wasn't. What that did offer me was an opportunity to never come back to NA, because you're all fucking each other, and there's the word God on the wall, that freaked me out. That alone would have been enough, but then with the kind of term as 13th step, and at the time I just thought I kind of thought that's what happened. So I didn't come back for a few years. And what I have actually subsequently found out is that that guy, he had like about 5 years clean then, and he stayed clean for probably for about 10 years, and then he relapsed, and I think he's in and out of the rooms now. But what I will say about that experience for me with the 13th step, and one detrimental effect that has had on me, is I am supremely judgmental of that, and of that going on in the fellowship now. I mean, judgmental to my detriment. A, it's none of my business what other people do. And there was this wonderful analogy that was offered to me. It's like there's a defect tree, and if on one branch someone sat on there with lust and I'm sat on another one with being judgmental, it's the same fucking tree. And so I kind of, I struggle with that, being judgmental. And don't get me wrong, women do it as well. It's not just a man thing. Yeah, that, I found that a little bit tricky. Anyway, so, what happened next?
How much time have I got?
Oh, I got loads.
Okay.
Okay. Still terrified, but I'm going through it. That's my sponsor. Hi. Right. But so let's fast forward to when I got clean this time. As I said, that I read the literature and stuff, and I saw in there, so it said, a lot about a rock bottom. So I thought, all right, I've got to find one of them. And in hindsight, I had plenty of rock bottoms. And I'm quite a fantasist. And I actually, and when I saw that rock bottom, and what I'm going to say now, I in no way mean to belittle the people who have experienced these things, but for me, I kind of fantasized about being mugged or being raped or being for having a disease or any of these things, that then that could be my big drama for why I got clean. And when people say, well, why don't you drink or use them? Oh, this terrible thing happened and therefore I had to. I kind of thought that there had to be this big drama, and then that would make me doing one of these more interesting and all of that. But my rock bottom was so run-of-the-mill boring. It was nothing. It was me. I was in a bar. It was in Los Angeles. I was in a bar, pissed, and I was with these random guys I didn't know, didn't sleep with them, and I was kind of, I remember kind of talking, but like being so pissed, not stringing a sentence together, and then I can remember them looking at me, kind of willing me to make sense, going, "Come on, girl, you can do it. Have a sentence," and but I couldn't do it. But nothing would come out. I couldn't like string a sentence together, and then I remember, oh, fuck it, and then just what, staggering home. And then that was it. That was the last time I drank. That's nothing. I've had much worse experiences than that in using. And then woke up the next day and go, oh, that was horrible. And then let's have a bottle of wine. And then that was it. So then the next day, all of my family kind of knew and had labelled me an alcoholic about 10 years previously. So that was no great surprise to me when I said I think I might be an alcoholic. But when I told them, by this time I've got a raging Coke habit, by the way, I missed that bit out. But yeah, and so when I told them about the Coke, they were a little bit more surprised. So I told my auntie about it, and she knew some people who ran a treatment centre in Suffolk. And so she made some phone calls to me. I was getting on a plane back to England like 2 days later or something. And I was living in Dorset at this time. I didn't want to go back to Dorset because my career was running pubs as well, which was beautiful. And so I couldn't go back to work. And didn't want to go back to Dorset because I knew that I would drink and use there. Didn't really want to stay. I could have stayed in London. Didn't really want to stay here. I'd done a lot of drinking and using here as well. I didn't know what to do. So, just literally the luckiest person that I am is that this treatment centre... Oh, also, I didn't have a pot to piss in either. So I didn't have any money to go to treatment. And this treatment centre... does this, it's like a charity-based thing, and so if someone turns up with a genuine desire to get clean and they've got a bed available, they'll just put you through it on, like, good faith. Amazing. So I got in. It was just so lucky that there was a bed at that place. There was a position, that's not the right word. There was a place available on the course. There was a bed. It was crazy. It was just kind of... So I got back from America on the Friday. By the Wednesday, I was on a train to the Bury St. Edmunds, which sounded like some make-believe place. So I kind of... It was ridiculous. And so I just went there, and this wonderful woman met me from the train station, and we kind of... And I was just... And all the way there, and now looking back, probably higher power stuff, But I had no idea what the fuck I was doing. I had no idea why I was getting on that train. I have no idea why I was... It's similar to what Matty said as well. It's like, literally, my two options were killing myself or seemingly, for me, going to rehab, getting clean. Those were my options. And the killing myself probably would have been less fear-provoking than the one that I chose. I'm very grateful that I made that choice, but I don't... Maybe it was just that last kind of glimmer of hope that got me, that I didn't know was there, that got me to treatment. And so I rocked up there. And basically, this is where my kind of people pleasing and... so not all defects have to be terrible. The fact that I am an inherent people pleaser held me in wonderful stead in treatment and in early recovery because I did what I was told. And everything... it was everything, pretty much everything. I went along and I don't really know what to say about treatment. It was a kind of amazing experience, and I think that anyone would benefit from that, addict or non-addict. Anyone would benefit from going somewhere for 4 months or however long and just really getting to know themselves and understanding and having a load of other human beings willing to go, do you know what, you might be a little bit arrogant. Well, do you know what, I think that... So at the time, it was mortifying and they were wrong. But as time went on, there was this one time in group when they... fuckers. So we were in this kind of group, all round in a circle, and literally, I don't even know whether they chatted with each other beforehand and decided to kill me that day. And so we all just sat around, and then out of nowhere, they said that I was arrogant, a bully, that hurt, superficial, judgmental, they had a point. And so all of these things, they just kind of bombarded me with information about myself. And at the time, terrible. So I had a panic attack. I might have acted a panic attack, but I had to leave the room anyway. And so I kind of left, and then I phoned my sponsor, and I was like, outrage that these fuckers are saying this to me, and I didn't really like them anyway. But that was actually a kind of a turning point for me, because from that point on, when I kind of got over the disgust and shock of what they were saying, it was actually, they were obviously spot on, and I have I'm capable of being all of those things, and I've got a load of assets that I'm capable of too, which I won't bother going into, but they are there, I know they are. That was a turning point in treatment for me, because that's what it's all about really now. For me, it's challenging myself and my kind of support. I've got like 3 or 4 people who I take everything to, and if they don't challenge me on it when I'm not behaving in a spiritual manner, then they've not really got any business being in my support group. That's a bit harsh, but yeah. And it's the same vice versa. If someone was to come to me with some stuff that they're dealing with and I kind of pussyfoot around it and go, I'll be alright, pray for it, when in actual fact you need to fucking stop doing what you're doing and maybe look at like changing your behaviour a little bit. I wouldn't say that to everyone, though, just the people in my group. Hang on. I'm doing all right, aren't I?
So far.
Yeah, right. I've still got 10 minutes. So that was treatment for me. It was a kind of wonderful and fulfilling experience. And even at the time, I kind of thought that something great was happening there, even amongst all of that fear and the unknown. Maybe that little glimmer of hope that I had when I was on the train going to Bury was kind of grew, and I was like, actually something special might be happening here, not just for me, for the other people in there as well, of which there are obviously, sadly, only a few who are still clean. So what I did what I was told. I got a sponsor. They said don't get in a relationship for the first year. I said, you're bloody right, I won't get in a relationship for the first year. For me, because I was actually quite fearful around, I don't know how honest to get, I was quite around the whole sex stuff. That scared me, obviously, because of the my experience with sex, that, as I spoke about earlier on, was always quite sordid and drunken. And so it was never a caring, kind of loving experience. It was always just kind of, fucking hell, really? Just tell me you love me and then we'll be fine, which never happened. So that So I was actually really fearful of having sex sober for the first time. That kind of, so when it was offered, maybe don't get in a relationship, I went, yeah, all right, that's fine. But then the kind of downside to that for me is when I got to like 10, 12 months, and then it was clearly, it was kind of all right for me to start getting into a relationship. The fear of it had built up to such an extent then, where I was like, I don't think I can, it's been too long. Yeah. And I actually didn't get into it. I was about 18 months when I had my first boyfriend. He was a counsellor at the treatment centre. Of course he was. Him. I really did love him. and he is still a very dear friend of mine, but just because you're a counsellor doesn't mean that you've necessarily worked through all of your issues. I did not know that. I definitely did not know that when we first got into the relationship. But he is adorable. He is adorable. So yeah, and what I experienced in that relationship was not only that it's okay to have sex sober and it can be quite fun, but also how to end a relationship in a dignified manner. I'd never done that before. And not only I ended it, even I was so pathetically in love with him, but it just wasn't right. It wasn't, he couldn't give me what I deserved, basically. So my choice was either continue in that relationship with him, which I think he would have been all right with, or end it and get on with the rest of my life and kind of go through that grieving process. It hurt a lot. As I said, ending it the way that I did, with the dignity and integrity that I did, was probably the most freeing and self-esteem building thing that I've ever done in my life. And really that's what it's all about for me now. And it's kind of doing things like this too that build self-esteem and self-worth. Facing those fucking fears, of which I have plenty. Another reason not for me, definitely, that it was a right move not to get into a relationship in that first year, is because I'm not sure I could have handled that without having a bit of recovery and working most of the steps and having a sponsor and having the people, because that stuff hurts. Downer. What else have I got? Yeah. Got a blank, hang on. So I could do the whole going through the steps one by one and tell you what I think of them, but I won't. But what I will say is that when I first came in and got over the God word, for me the religious connotation of that was terrifying and confusing. And it's just so simple when it's broken down with a sponsor, just kind of going, it can be as complicated as you want it to be. And my higher power has certainly evolved over the amount of time that I've been clean. Well, it started off with just being a kind of knowing, or kind of just an understanding that there might possibly be something out there which is more powerful than me. Now I know most things are more powerful than me. But it's kind of evolved now, and now it... In fact, you know, I don't even have to define it. I heard someone in a meeting years ago say she took so long to kind of be able to clarify exactly what her higher power was, so she could sit in a meeting and tell someone else about it. And it's no one else's business, it's so personal. And all I know is that I have a deep belief that everything will be all right. That I believe on a massive, kind of very freeing level. It might not all be brilliant, but it will definitely be all right. And that would fucking do me, that's fine. So when I got over that God word, the four steps that really turned me on was 4 and 5 and 8 and 9. I thought the idea, which is weird, the idea of kind of writing an inventory and really kind of getting to know myself and offloading all of my shit onto another person, and kind of, that sounded quite nice. I thought that's fine, I can do that. And then the that was rude, I didn't mean to be rude. And then 8 and 9. I'm getting a bit too comfortable now, aren't I? And then 8 and 9, I thought, looked really appealing because... Thank you. Oh! 8 and 9 looked really appealing because that meant that I would be forgiven. Brilliant. I could go up to people and say, yeah, sorry about that. And then I go, that's all right. And then I go about my business. And neither of them were really quite that simple. Four and five, I found it, I did it in 2 weeks, not the best move. I got up, given my step four, and I said, all right, brilliant. And so I thought, if I do it as quickly as I possibly can, get it over and done with, because I'd heard a lot of people who take years to do step four, and I thought, I don't want to be one of them, I want to do it quick, stylish. So what happened with me doing it in 2 weeks is that I had like 24, 25 years of pain and drama in 2 weeks. So all of those feelings and shame and just doom and all of that stuff just came up in 2 fucking weeks, as opposed to like the couple of months that normal people would take to do it. Thank you. And too comfortable. Sorry. So yeah. So that happened. And then the other thing that I obviously didn't do is I didn't write even one asset down on a bit of paper at all, nowhere to be seen, just how much of a terrible bastard I was. That's all I wrote down. Foolish. And then I shared my step five. And that wasn't, for me, it wasn't this big, massive experience. It was just a kind of knowing it was certainly a relief. And a relief for my sponsor to relate to some of the things that I wrote down in that, and to go, actually, yeah, I did that. Things that I thought that no one else had done, self-centered, and it wasn't. Sometimes you hear that big like lightning bolt or wonderful moment when you do step five. That wasn't my experience. None of this has been like for me. It's been a kind of like a beautiful process that I've kind of flown through, not drifted, because there's been a bit of work involved, Yeah, and then 8 and 9, well, it wasn't me going up going, sorry about that, and I'm going, it's all right. It was, most of them were pretty straightforward thus far. My mum's was tricky, but that's too long and boring to go into. But what I actually haven't done, I mean, I've gone on to work the other steps, but I haven't done my financial amends yet. And that I feel a little bit... more annoyed at myself that I haven't done that. The reason I haven't done that is because I don't want these people to know that I was a thief. I feel uncomfortable with that. There was this pub that I worked in and there was money going missing out the till. It didn't even cross their mind that it was me, because I was such a nice person. And so they would come up to me and go, Mia, someone's thieving, I don't know who it is. Who do you think it is? Oh, well, I don't know, Amy. And it was me, and so I'm going to have to go, and I have to do this, and me sharing about it here will spur me on to do it, because the only thing that's stopping me is ego. It's because I want them to like me, and do you know what, the chances are that I've been friends with them for enough years that they probably fucking will after I tell them, and if they don't, then they don't, and at least then I'll be free of that. I think that... Yeah, I think that if we work in the steps, I don't completely understand why people don't work the steps when they come in here. I understand that it's scary, I get that. But what's on offer from working those steps, or what I gained from working those steps, was an understanding and a complete acceptance that I'm not a bastard. I did not know that before. That I'm not this horrible person, that I'm actually quite giving and quite caring, and I was going to say sweet then, but that's not true. But I am a good person, I am, and I know that through working those steps and working them in my life. I didn't know before. I might think I might be done. I should come up with something quite profound now. Thank you.